Hello and welcome to the Science Fiction Book Review Podcast. My name is Luke Burridge and this is the show where I review every single science fiction book that I read as I read it. There's no set schedule, I just finish the book, do the review, stick it up here on the podcast feed to everyone to download and listen to. And thanks a lot for all the emails that I've got over the past week or so. I put out a new episode recently after a break of almost a month or something like that. So that seemed to get a good reaction. So keep sending emails. I do reply to every email that I get. So keep up the conversations, keep sending me stuff, keep sending me the book recommendations. Email me, luke@juggler.net. That is the best way to get hold of me. So I'm going to skip any kind of news or anything like that. I'm just going to jump straight into today's review because I've got a feeling it might go a little bit long. I've only got a few notes. Let me check my notes here. I've only got like 10 lines of notes, 20 lines of notes. No, not even that. But I've probably got quite a lot to say about this. So I'll just stick with the normal format. So this is The Mote in God's Eye by Larry Niven and Jerry Pournelle. And here I'm on the Goodreads.com page. It said it was first published in 1974. And these guys actually wrote a number of books together. I reviewed Lucifer's Hammer maybe last year, and then there's Mote in God's Eye, and then there's another novel which they're well known for, which is called Footfall, which is an alien invading Earth science fiction novel, and this one is a first contact novel. It's the first contact that the aliens have had with humans, and it's the first contact that humans have had with the aliens. So I actually read this book years and years ago, probably about 15 years ago, and I remember enjoying it, but I didn't remember too much about it. All I remembered were the aliens, because the aliens in this book are pretty fascinating. It's a really interesting thing that they've done here. Larry Niven, if you've read Ringworld and the other books like that, you'll see that he's... review Ringworld? I don't think I ever did. No, I never reviewed Ringworld. Maybe I'll go back and read that again for this podcast. But he does fascinating aliens and does alien cultures really well. Get together with Jerry Pournelle. I'm not sure who wrote what in this book, but there is definitely good aliens in this, like there is in Footfall and like there is in Ringworld and Larry Niven's other books. So I'm sure it's Larry Niven's kind of stuff going in there. Maybe a lot of the technology ideas are Jerry Pournelle, because that's the kind of thing that he normally does well. So, yes, I decided to read this again, mainly because lots of people were saying, hey, you should review it, but also because on the SFF Audio podcast with Jesse and Scott and Julie and those guys over there, they did a read-along, and they recorded their own thoughts about this a few weeks ago, and so I listened to that last week, and after listening to it, now I have a few more thoughts in my head, a few more points that they mentioned, but you don't need to go and listen to that podcast to enjoy this one, but I will maybe reference some of their views in this as well. I don't often read other people's reviews before recording one of my podcasts, because I want it to be my own thoughts and not really other people's thoughts. But in this case, it was good to listen to some friends of mine who I often read books with or read along with or take part in these podcasts, even though I didn't have time to take part in that podcast recording. But you check it out, sffaudio.com, I think. You can find the podcast there or search for it on iTunes. Anyway, getting into this. So setting up the world of this book. So it's set in year 3000 AD, 1,000 years in the future, and Earth they had this sort of like co-dominium period where it seems like the main movers and shakers in the Cold War sort of patched up their differences and went out and explored space together. So a lot of the culture has its roots in both American culture and in Russian culture, even though there's lots of other cultures that are mentioned in the book. You've got Arabs and Russians, and I think there's some French people there as well, and Scottish people. But yeah, lots of different nationalities still exist somehow in space. So the co-dominion went out, and then that empire fell, and that was the first empire of man, which sort of spans throughout here in the Goodreads page. It says in the year 3016, the second empire of man spans hundreds of star systems. So the first empire fell, and then a second empire rose, and they don't have the same level of technology as the first empire, but they've still got some pretty good starships. The starships can jump around faster than light, but they can only do it from certain points between stars. So they go out out to the edge of one solar system and then jump to the edge of another solar system and then go into the middle of that solar system, but they can't just jump through space at any point that they want. They have to get into the right place. So they have these like atomic drives that are fusion drives that can get them there quickly. And also the other big invention is, let me just bring up the Wikipedia page here, the technology that they have. There'll be a section here. I can't find it. So they have the... Nope, I can't find it. But they have the different Murchison drive, or no, the Murchison's eye. Anyway, they've got some different thing, like a different shield, which they can go even into the edge of a sun because the shield around the spaceship is so good. So what we have at the beginning is we see a little bit of action between starships and a planet and stuff, and you can see that the Imperial setup is quite brutal to some people, and they're trying to reestablish a single empire. They're saying we have to have a single empire of man, because if there's any kind of rebellion, humans will turn against humans. And it's a bit strange to say this, that like the one sort of Imperial kind of setup, they're saying that this is the right way to do it. This is the right way. This is the only political system. We have to have a single unit. We have to have a single leader of all humanity. Otherwise, that'll be bad for humanity, which I actually, you know, disagree with. I think the more different, the more countries or the more groups of people who are going out and exploring the world, the better, because some will be able to survive and some won't be able to survive. So just imagine if, say, the human star systems under one leadership come together and face an alien threat and get wiped out by that alien threat because they're a single unit. What happens to humanity then? Whereas I would say spread out throughout the stars, get as much spread as possible, get as many people doing different things, get as many different people. And if people fight, that's great, but it'll be a lot more, a lot less homogenous. It's that kind of thing now, there's only one species of banana left in the world because all the species of banana have died out and there's only like a monoculture left. And I say we need not just monocultures of society and man and political systems. Anyway, so you've got this second empire, and I'm not quite sure what else to say now, except what happens, and I'll get a bit into the plot here. So what happens is there is this nebula called the Coalsack Nebula, and there's this super giant red giant star called Murchison's Eye, and then there's another little star which floats around it called the Mote in God's Eye, because the Murchison's Eye looks like an eye in a big hooded cloak, which is the rest of the Coalsack Nebula. And this Coalsack Nebula is right in the middle of human space. There's the different places, you know, there's these different planets. On one side, you've got Sparta, which is the capital planet of the Second Empire, and these other things on one side. And then on the other side of the Coalsack Nebula, you've got some outposts of humanity there as well. And then you've got New Caledonia, which is a Scottish kind of setup planet, a Scottish nation controlling this one planet, and that's sort of like the sector capital. And from New Caledonia, the Mote in God's Eye is floating in the middle of Murchison's Eye, so that's where the name of the novel comes from. It comes from this star. So what happens is that during some kind of mopping up exercises after them putting down a rebellion, a commander called Rod Blaine is in charge of a ship, and he is sent out to intercept this this alien probe that is coming in on a light sail from Murchison's Eye, or from the Mote in God's Eye, and it's coming in towards the New Caledonian system. And so he goes out, and they find that there is an alien on board, a non-human alien, which is obviously sentient because they built this starship that goes between the Coalsack Nebula and New Caledonia. And so they said, well, we got to now work out who is going to go and check out, who's going to go and do the first contact. And Roderick Blaine, he has political connections. So even though he's a rookie pilot, he's a rookie captain, even though he's only been a commander for just a few days or a few weeks or something like that, he is suddenly put in charge of this first contact, which immediately makes me think, well, why has he been put in charge here? And I didn't understand why, because he wasn't very good at what he did. He had a very strong command, but as a character, he didn't really seem to have anything going for him except some political connections, but then he wasn't going to be in the Navy much more. Anyway, he was a very, very frustrating lead character because he is he's one of these superheroes. He doesn't need to learn anything. He just does the right thing. He never fails at anything. He just does the right thing. And if he does fail at it, it's like, oh, but you're the good guy. You're the good guy. Say, hey, you can do this kind of thing. I'll get more into some of the other characters in this book. I pause there. Characters, meaning like, in, I'm waggling my fingers around, characters in this book. So he gets sent off and then they arrive around and there's another starship that goes with them, and the two starships that go, one is called MacArthur and one is called Lennon, but I like to think of them as Lennon and McCartney for no reason at all. It's just when I was listening to the audiobook, that's always what I thought, the Lennon and get mixed up now myself. So you get these two spaceships and they go, and one of the spaceships has to do the first contact, and then the Lennon, which is commanded by Admiral Kutuzov, they're just there as backup. And so then we have first contact, and we get into the motives. Now, I don't really want to explain too much about the motives at this point, but there's different kinds of aliens. The first one that we meet is an engineer. And they're not really sentient, or they are kind of sentient. We're not really quite sure what sentience is, but they're sort of like a subspecies of motives. And actually, all of them are subspecies of motives. And then we also find there's some masters, and there's some mediators, and all of them have got slightly different, they've got different fur color, which is very important. And then they've got different numbers of arms and different shapes of heads, in the same way that, say, a human is one, looks like one thing, and then a Neanderthal looks slightly different, and then an ape looks something different, and a monkey looks something different. They're all of the same stock. And all of these different motis, as they're called, these different alien species, have evolved over many, many years. And some of it has been forced evolution, that they've bred themselves to be one way or the other. The masters have bred engineers, and the masters have bred these little aliens called the Watchmakers. And they've bred these things, which are lots of different tiny little aliens, and lots of big aliens, and there's farming motis and running motis, and there's even a meat moti, which I thought was quite strange. And the way that this works is that they've been isolated on this planet, circling around this star. And humans, they've got this interstellar drive, but the aliens never developed that. Oh, they did, but the jump point from one star to the next, to their closest star, the only jump point that they have, actually is into the center, or into the outer part of this red giant sun, which the human ships get through no problem at all, because they've got this shield device on their ships where they can just jump in, and it doesn't matter because the star is there, but they can just go in with a shield, no problem at all. The motis never developed that, so the only way that they ever managed to cross from their planet to their solar system to another one is by this probe. They called it the Crazy Eddie probe. I quite like the idea of this Crazy Eddie kind of thing. The Crazy Eddie was one of the motis. So if any moti does something outside of the normal kind of system, the normal kind of political system, or the normal scientific thought, he's called Crazy Eddie. And if he fails, he's called Crazy Eddie. But if he succeeds, he's not longer called Crazy Eddie. And they just do this. So anytime anyone does something strange in the moti civilization, it's Crazy Eddie this and Crazy Eddie did that. And it doesn't matter what they're really called. They're just referred to as Crazy Eddie. And then the rest of the book is really about the humans studying the motis studying the humans, and trying to work out if either of them are a threat to the other. So that's all I want to really say now about the world and the setup. If I go into it more, there will be a lot more spoilers. But what is really interesting about this is, from a scientific point of view, from a science fictional point of view, is this first contact. The aliens are, I think, fascinating. I really enjoy the idea of having a race which is stuck on like an alien species made up of many different kind of races stuck on a single planet or within a single star system, and they're stuck there, and they're there, and then millions of years go by, and they're still on the same planet, and millions of years go by, and they're still on the planet. So they go into this cycle of rising empires and civilizations that then collapse, and then they raise again, and then they collapse, and then once more, and then collapse. So you've got this cycle going on of different civilizations, and between the cycles, the motes sort of evolve in different ways, and then the motes come back. And they have these things called libraries, where if once a moti starts, once sort of like a moti civilization raises up to a certain point, then they can go into these libraries, into these big museums, and find old technology, and then use it to sort of resurrect a star-going civilization. Really interesting kind of thing there. And every other kind of animal in this system has died out. They've got plants, which survive some of the wars, but otherwise all of the animals over the millions of years have been eaten, and that's why they have something like the meat moti. So in once civilization collapses, you've got this really, really, really dumb alien called the moti, which is a subspecies of the master motis and of the other intelligent motis, but you just there, and then you can eat your moti. And you can eat your meat moti, which is a distant cousin, and I quite like that idea. And there's different things going on with the aliens as well. All of them first of all, you think they're all female, and then some of them are male, but mostly it's female. And then you realize that a lot of them, that they're all hermaphrodites. So once they've had sex and impregnated a woman, then they change to a female, and then they have to be impregnated by a male, and then they have a baby. And once they've had a baby, then they change back to male again. So it's not only is the civilization cyclical, that one civilization gives birth to a next, that gives birth to a next. Actually, the gender and the sort of nurturing stage, and then the protection stage and the birth stage of the motis is also cyclical, which I quite like that thing, because that's the kind of thing that goes on with humans in a way, that you can have what they say, like a patriarchal society, a matriarchal society, and also the way that the human physiology works in a way that you have one person as the head, and then the head controls the body, and the body controls the brain controls the arms and the legs and all these different functions of the human. But everyone in the human society is uniform in a way. Like everyone's got two arms, two legs, and a head and a body and things. Whereas the motis, they're all mismatched, and that's sort of like the society is mismatched as well as their bodies are mismatched. Again, it's a really interesting kind of alien species here, and I think Larry Niven probably had the most say in this kind of stuff. So, technologically, though, the motis are very advanced, or they can be very advanced, in the same way that the human empire has fought. The first empire fell, and it took with it a lot of knowledge of the different technology. That's what happens with the motis as well. When the empires fall, when the civilization falls because of, you know, overpopulation or war or anything like that, then they rebuild their population, and they've got to rediscover the old technologies again. And and some of the motis, the watchmakers and the engineers, have been genetically manipulated over the years and selected for by natural selection to become these master engineers, these master things, so they can just see something, and just by looking at it, they sort of intuit its use, and everything, they can just improve it and make it work better. Which, of course, is a bit tricky, because when the humans arrive, suddenly they've got new technology that turns up. In the past, they've discovered this kind of technology, and then they've lost it, and then they've discovered it and lost it. This is the motis. And then they see working examples of the star drive, working examples of the of that kind of stuff, and you realize that, if the motis ever get this technology, they'll be able to just make it more efficient, more impressive, more everything. Bigger, better, because that's the kind of thing that the engineer motis do. So, that's more about that. What do I normally talk about now? Oh yeah, so let's talk about a bit about the story. I really don't like stories where all of the drama is driven by stupid people doing stupid things and then having to get out of that situation. If anybody in this story... Okay, there are a few competent people in this story. And but they are either ignored because they're not royalty, because there's the way that it's set up that, yeah, I'm an imperial lord person and I have the say, and this other person is in the high up in the military and he does what kind of stuff. So there are some people who have a lot of sense. Roderick Blaine, their main character, isn't one of them. Sally, the love interest, Sally, whatever it is, she isn't one of them. There's a priest, which sometimes has some good sense. Not the priest, the chaplain, sorry, in there as well. Actually, let me just check. Someone posted a link to a list of characters. Here we go. So there are some people who do have sense. For example, Midshipman Jonathan Whitbread, he gets put into situations and he does really well. And then there's the, what's his name? Who's the navigation officer? I can't see the name of the navigation officer as well. But he knows what he's doing. In every situation, they go, okay, what's going on here? And he just knows what to do. He plots the course. Oh, yeah, Kevin Renner, sailing master lieutenant of the Imperial Space Navy Reserve. Everything that he just does, and he's good at what he does, and that's good. Because, you know, he's from a merchant family. He's been brought up to be independent and everything like that. And he knows what he's doing. And there's a few of these little characters who know what they're doing. Now, everyone in power is really, really stupid. First, I thought Admiral Sir Vladimir Richard George Plekhanov. Oh no, not him. What's the guy? I can't find his name now. But there's the other admiral. I've lost his name now. His name is Admiral Kutuzov. So there's Admiral Kutuzov. At first I thought, well, he's a guy who's brutal, but he knows what he's doing and he has the best interest at heart. So what happens is that they, after a few stupid moves by Roderick, which just through his stupidity or by his bullheadedness, somehow it comes out right. Now, if the book had been written any other way, like, it's purely luck that he comes out ahead in most of the situations that he gets himself into. And yet somehow this is classed as intelligence. At one point, someone looks at him and goes, well, how did he know what to do? Well, he didn't know what to do, but he knew to ask someone who did know what to do. And I'm like, well, why didn't they just get the guy who did know what to do in charge? And it's like, well, his good leadership quality is being able to judge characters and know who's good, know who can be trusted, know who's best to do the job at the moment. I'm like, great. But then he picks people to do stuff who aren't very good, and yet his initial character isn't, or his initial character assessments of other people aren't questioned. So he's good because he picks good people to do good stuff, and yet when he doesn't do that, when he picks people to do good stuff and makes a mistake, that's not like a knock against his intelligence, that's a knock against other people's intelligence. I'm like, well, why don't they just put Kevin Renner in charge? He's obviously the guy who knows what he's doing. Sure, he's not a long-term Korea Navy guy because he's going to go back and become a space merchant again, but those are the kind of people that you need. So what happens is they arrive in the system and immediately do something which I'm thinking, well, why do they do that? That's stupid. And then they do something else. I'm like, why do they do that? That's stupid. And you're thinking, like, first contact, okay, have some kind of quarantine. Immediately they break quarantine. I'm like, well, why are you breaking quarantine? And then, of course, that backfires on them later, and they start communicating with the aliens. I'm like, why are you communicating like this? And then they do, and that leads to something stupid as well. At every point, when anybody does something stupid, I'm like, well, why are you doing this? This is a stupid thing. And at every point, the stupid thing backfires and is bad for them. And at some points, they do something stupid, which doesn't backfire. But then I'm like, why is this thing that they do stupid, which doesn't backfire and results in something good, why is that held up as good leadership? If I was doing this thing, why send two ships? Send four ships. And why send one ship and then one backup ship? Why not send one ship and four backup ships? Why not send eight backup ships? This is the first contact. You don't know what you're facing. You don't know what kind of level. And at every point, they underestimate the aliens. Every single time that they see anything to do with the aliens, they presume that the aliens are stupider, weaker, less intelligent, less capable. I don't know how to say it, like, less of them. They underestimate the biology, they underestimate the technology, they underestimate the age, they underestimate everything. They take for granted everything that the aliens say, even as they are lying to the aliens. They believe the aliens. Everything that the aliens tell them, they take as truth. And I'm just like, what the hell are you thinking? Why is everybody in this book really, really stupid? Now, there are a few good characters who aren't so stupid. There's this one guy called Horace Hussein Berry. And Horace Hussein Berry is a, he's like this Arabic kind of merchant guy. And at the beginning, I think, well, he's, you know, he's not stupid. He's a traitor. And they just, he gets put with Lord Roderick Blaine. And they say, okay, Roderick Blaine, you have to look after this traitor. He's not under arrest, but you're not allowed to let him off your ship. Which I thought was quite good. But then you realize, why is he being brought along to a first contact mission if he's a known traitor or a suspected traitor? Get him off the ship. And it seems like the only reason they go is like, oh, well, he's a trader guy. We need a trade representative. And I'm like, Kevin Renner, this Kevin Renner guy, he can also be a trade representative. And he's a good guy. So why don't make him a captain? He can be an Imperial contact, or he can be, you know, he can be the Navy contact and a merchant contact. He's the guy that we need. Kevin Renner is the, he should be the hero. But no, they have this known traitor as their first point of trade contact between a new civilization, a new alien species. I'm like, what the fuck is going on here? So that's a bit weird. And then he does stupid things, but because he's greedy. And he's all, you know, motivated by trade, and he wants to do this kind of thing. So he does do one stupid thing. But as soon as he works out what he's done is stupid, he's like, okay, I made a mistake. From now on, I'm going to do the best thing. I'm going to be the voice of reason. I'm always going to do the best that I possibly can to get the best out of this situation, not just for me, but for everyone. And yet he is still kind of the villain throughout the piece. And sure, he did do one thing stupid, but he learns his lesson. And nobody else seems to learn their lesson. Admiral Kutuzov, I thought he was going to be intelligent, and he seemed to be intelligent, and then at the end he just like goes, oh well, I'm in charge of this mission, I've got these very, very set orders, at this point in the mission, if something like this happens, I know exactly what to do. And then he just breaks the law, well not breaks the law, he breaks his orders, just something else, just gets talked around by the other really, really stupid people on the mission, and he just goes, oh well, I'll listen to the advice of all these really, really stupid people, and then I'll do something really, really stupid. So yeah, the characters are all really, really stupid, and that seems to be what drives the plot. Now, there could have been a lot of other things driving the plot. Say, intelligent cooperation with the aliens, intelligent investigation of the alien. For example, they send along an anthropologist. The head anthropologist has political connections. She's a lady. She's some kind of duchess or something. I don't know what she is, but she's got political connections to the Imperial, you know, command structure. I'm not entirely sure. I can't remember exactly what it is. She's like, her uncle is going to be the sector head or in charge of some council or something like that. So she's really important. And she is a trainee anthropologist. And she, at the beginning of the book, is setting out on her first ever anthropology mission. And she is put in charge of a lot to do with this. I'm like going, really? Is that the best you can do? We need a female character, and the female character has got something to do. We're told that she's an idiot. She's told that she's naive. She has not an idiot, but we're told that she has no experience about anything. And yet she's put in charge of this mission. And I was just dumbfounded at this. It's like, who is organizing this? Is this really? And we're told that the Imperial fleet and the Imperial thing, the only way to keep this thing together. And I can't believe, look, if this is a book about how bad human society is, if it was an Imperial thing and it was all run by political connections and all that kind of stuff, if that's what the message of this book is about, this would be a good thing. But it's like, it's really unsatisfying to read a book about shallow, stupid. Oh, I haven't even gotten to how shallow these characters are. You know, last episode that I recorded, I mentioned that Why Call Them Back from Heaven by Clifford D. Simak. There's lots of shortcuts to the characters. They say, well, this character is fat, and therefore he is a bad character, and this character is tall and upstanding. And in that book, it works because what we have is a very short book, and we need shortcuts to people's characters to then develop them in different ways. Like, the guy with the beard is crazy because he's got a beard, and the guy who is, you know, looks avuncular is a nice guy because he's got, like, you know, small glasses or something like that, and the guy who squints a lot is going to be bad. That is okay for a book which is around about, you know, 120 pages long, and you're going to read it in a few hours, and they're shortcuts to, like, they're more archetypes rather than stereotypes. But what we have here in this book are stereotypes. And boy, are they bad stereotypes. Like I say, Lord Roderick Blaine, our main guy, Rod Blaine, is, you know, he's just a hero. And why is he a hero? Well, it's because he's a prince, or he's going to be a prince, or something like that, I can't remember. And that's why he's a hero. Why? Because he's going to be a prince. And why is he here? I just watched Tangled last night, which is a new Disney movie. And it's the same kind of thing. It's like, well, of course she's beautiful. Why is she beautiful? Because she's a princess. Yeah, but what's that got to do with it? Well, she's a princess. Of course, she's beautiful. And then you actually see real royal family members, and they go, well, you know, some of them look pretty good. They marry into good, you know, they get good blood in. And they marry good-looking girls to try and get some good blood into the royal family. But the princes don't look, they're not just really good-looking, you know. And then there's these people, it's like, well, of course he's a good leader. Why is he a good leader? Well, because he's got political. And you're just thinking, well, why are these people like this? And yeah, that's a bit strange, the stuff going on there. And yeah, and you get the, like, the near the end of the book, you meet Sally's uncle, and he's one of the richest men in the world, but, you know, he dresses like, you know, Harry Seldon, you know, that kind of thing. He's got his old jacket on. He dresses like an old professor. And I'm like, really? This is the kind of thing that you're going for? And again, to be really, really kind to this book, you could be saying, well, these are archetypes of humans. Human society is made up of these very well-defined things in the same way that the Moti society is made up of these things. They have the masters, and then they have the watchmakers, and they have the engineers, and they have the farmers, and each of these things are, they have a single personality. But in the end, the different mediators had different personalities. They had different views on things in the Moti society. So are we saying that in the Moti society, where everyone is genetically engineered to be different and to fit into their little boxes, within those boxes, they can have more variety than the little boxes that we have in human society? But it's a bit strange. Like, if that is it, why didn't we have less characters who all look the same to make that point, rather than spending, this was like 20-hour audiobook that I listened to here, 500, 600 pages, and probably about 600 pages we've got here, spending time with these one-dimensional, really, really boring characters. Getting onto this love story, again, we have a female character, a single female character, a single human character, because like I say, the motives aren't just females, they cycle through them. She is good looking, of course, and she's a princess. And at one point in the book, she's going, oh, well, you know, I will find someone to marry one day, and I think I might have already found him. And I'm thinking, what? Are we talking about Jonathan Whitbread? He's the midshipman. He, you know, he's a bit roly-poly, but he's obviously the most capable guy. He's the most interesting man on this entire ship. And I'm thinking, oh, maybe Kevin Renner, because she's hung out with Jonathan Whitbread because they were together working with the Motis. And then it's like, and then it turns out that no, it's not. It's Roderick, Lord Blaine, Roderick Harold Blaine, or whatever his name is. And I'm thinking, wait a second, you spent no time with this guy, but he's a prince and you're a princess and you're going to get together. Why? Because he's a prince and you're a princess? And it's like, why are you falling? And there was nothing, there was no connection between the two of them. It was just, he was good looking and very, very rich. And she, her name is Lady Sally Bright, no, Sandra Bright Fowler, and she's got connections as well. And of course they're going to fall in love. And at the end they say, oh, well, it's very handy as a political thing. Oh, but I love you. I love you too. And it's a political marriage. I know it's a political marriage, but I still love you. Yeah, yeah, I love you too. And I'm like, what's going on here? Kevin Renner was like the guy who was cool, and there was this Whitbread guy, Jonathan Whitbread. He had the first contact. He was the most important thing. If you really cared about being... because at the beginning she's like, yes, I'm this lady and I have these servants, but I'm going to go out there and make a name for myself as an anthropologist. It's going to be great. Who better to be with, you budding anthropologist, than what was his name? Jonathan Whitbread, who was the guy who made the first contact with the aliens in the first place. He knows most. He was there right at the very beginning when two alien species met for the first time. He represented humanity. Wouldn't that be cool if the princess fell in love with her? No, they didn't. Anyway, they get together, and by the end of the book, they're getting married. And so much time near the end of the book, they go back to, and they get married, and it's like, oh, for fuck's sake, every time these two characters were on the same page, I listened to it as an audiobook, every time these two characters were in my ears at the same time, I wanted to punch myself in the face repeatedly punch myself in the face, because it was so bad. Every time that the motives were in my ears, every time that we were talking about the aliens, this book was amazing. There was loads of stuff going on, and there was this and there was that, and when we were talking, you know, when Jonathan Whitbread and these other guys, they go down onto this planet, the surface of the planet, I was gripped. It was amazing. And then every time we cut back to Sally Fowler and Roderick Blaine, I was just like, shoot me now in the face. Shoot me now. Which brings me on to another character thing, which isn't character. This is like one of the main themes of this book. And the guys on the SFF Audio podcast picked up on some of this, but I really want to hammer this home. This is probably one of the most sexist and racist books I've read. And now, when I was reviewing Lucifer's Hammer, I thought maybe it was a coincidence that all of the white men in that book, all of the rich white men were the heroes, and then the groups of black people were literally cannibal hordes roving the landscape. And there was one non-cannibal black person who was worth spending time with, and or who, you know, who the other characters thought was a good guy. And he was, you know, that kind of exception that proves the rule. He was the black man made good who was a physicist, and he was an astronaut. And he landed and he came back down. The only way that a black person could prove his worth to the white post-apocalyptic society was that he had gone through NASA training and was an astronaut and managed to make his way safely back down to Earth. Now, I thought that could have just been a coincidence that all of the black people were literally cannibals and all of the white people were the good guys. And I thought, well, maybe it's just that kind of thing. But then in this book, I wouldn't quite say it was as blatant as that, but it was maybe because it was less blatant and that it was just there bubbling under the surface, the racism and the sexism. Actually, the sexism was blatant here, but the racism was even bad. So remember before when I talked about Horace Hussein Berry? He is the traitorous, like, he's the only person who's considered a traitor in this book. Right from the very beginning. And he is an Arab guy, and he's portrayed as the bad guy at the beginning of the book. There isn't really any kind of bad guy until maybe the aliens come along and then there's some other people. But he's the bad guy at the beginning. He's the villain at the beginning of the story. And he is the only, like, Arabic or Muslim character in the book. And all he is representing is the greedy Arab merchant. Now, if there was other merchants or other, like, non-greedy people who were also Arabs in this book, other heroes and other people who had names which didn't sound like Hussein, you'd think, well, okay, maybe this is just this one guy. But as a representative of all Arab people 3,000 years in the future, you're thinking, well, that's good. And then there was the black guys in the book that actually, no, I can't remember any mention of any character who was black. Maybe they were, but they maybe not. All of the heroic guys are white American. Like you say, there's this co-dominion guy, Roderick Blaine. That's a good American name. So he's a white guy. He's going to be good. The Russians. All of the Russians are these cold military types. Kutuzov, the Admiral Kutuzov, he is best known for bombing a planet and completely wiping out all human life on this planet by bombarding it from space. And that is what the Russians are known for. The Scots are known for being good technicians or something like that. And it just keeps going and going and going. And I was like, well, why? If it was just a stereotype, that's one thing. But, like, after reading Lucifer's Hammer, I'm thinking this isn't right. And again, I can't be fair about this, because 1974, didn't we know, or 1976, whenever this was written, didn't we know a bit more about it, that like all Arabs weren't greedy things? I mean, talking about Disney movies, I saw Aladdin a few months ago, and I was really surprised at the beginning of that, how kind of a little bit racist it is, where the trader comes in, and you're like, whoa, wait a second, is this the first kid's exposure to the Arabian Nights, and it's some kind of, like, racist portrayal of Arabic sort of, like, Muslim traders or something? Then nowadays you just think, whoa, even from something from the 90s, in a way. And maybe because I first read this when I was maybe 14 or 15 years old back in the 90s, maybe I didn't pick up on it so much, but I think it was just because I was 14 or 15 years old and I was more interested in the aliens, because that's all I remember from this. I don't remember the massive amounts of racism. But then you think, okay, let's cut across to the aliens. You think, well, the aliens, they're all different colors. Is it a coincidence that the white aliens with white fur are the intelligent ones, and the ones with brown fur are the ones who aren't sentient but are good with their hands? And then at one point, all the little aliens, the little motis, which are called the watchmakers, all the people on the ship call them the brownies. And I was thinking, they're going, really? Are they really calling the dark-skinned aliens brownies and the intelligent white aliens the motis? Again, if it was something like actually all of the black aliens were the good ones and the white aliens, who would, you know, because I was thinking before, it's like, okay, if you're an intelligent, you wear a white shirt, and if you're good with your hands, you use like you have like a blue overalls. And I was thinking, oh, maybe you could do something like that. But it wasn't white and blue, and it wasn't the intelligent ones were black or patchwork, and the other ones were white, and the stupid ones were white. It wasn't. It was just continuously reinforcing this utterly racist view. And also, I did pick up on the idea of the slanty eyes of the aliens. There is this sort of like out of control breeding theme going on as well. And Jesse on the SFF Audio picked this up and explained it very well about the yellow peril. And I think it's because we actually did this podcast about the yellow peril that I see this kind of thing now more in science fiction and books that I read, that we have the Americans and we got the Russians, and the Motis really do kind of like with their slanty Asian eyes, I think that's the quote in the book, really do represent the yellow peril of these hordes of people who, you know, there's a billion Chinese people out there and they're all our enemies and they're going to keep breeding, they're going to come over here and soon they're going to outnumber us, you know, us white Americans. And so there, like, there's just no mention of any kind of Chinese or any kind of Asian characters in the book, except, of course, the Motis, who seem to take that place. It's like, meanwhile, while the Americans and the Russians are getting on okay, we've got to look out for the Chinese and the Japanese. That's the kind of thing that it looks like is going on here. Going on to the sexism. Now, like I say, we have one female character in this book, and that is Sally. And she is a woman. And we're not allowed to forget that. Let me put it that way. Every time a character sees her at the beginning of the book, she is treated as a sex object first, and then as a woman, and then after a woman, she's treated as a love interest, and then after she's treated as a love interest, she's treated as an anthropologist, and then after as an anthropologist, she's treated as a human being with her own human identity right from the very beginning of the book. And it keeps going through, and it turns out she's put on this council at the end, and the only reason she's put on the council, there's literally a conversation which between her uncle, Sally's uncle, and Blaine, Lord Blaine, who is the hero of the book, and it goes something like this. It's like, well, there's going to be three of us on this council, what's her name? You know, Lord Fowler or whatever it is. Lord Fowler says, "Oh, there's going to be this council put together, and I'm going to be on it, and you're going to be on it as well, Roderick. And what about Sally? Well, Sally's going to be on it as well, but she's only on it because she's a woman, and she'll just do what I say anyway." And then our hero of the book goes, "Oh, that's great," and just goes with it. And I was thinking, what's going on here? Like, are you really going to treat a woman like that? Is that just going to be good? And we're expecting to root for you as a human species, as a human society that's meant to be good and wholesome and pure and everything like that. And you're the main character, and you're going again. And then later on, I actually made a note of this when I was listening to it. In the council, there's this main council at the end where there's the mediators, there's the diplomats, or what do you call them? The consul from the Motis, and you've got them talking to the main guys from the humans. And again, Sally Fowler is the only female there because she's a female, and because she's the wife of Roderick, and she's the niece of this other guy. That's the only reason. And she asks a question, and it's a good question, but instead of it saying it's a good question, Roderick turns to the aliens and he says something like that, "Answer the woman's question." And it's like, wait a second, whoa, go back. She is a member of this council. She's a lady in her own right. She's your wife. She's the niece of this person. She's got all these other things. She's a qualified anthropologist, even if one without experience. And what do you say to the representatives of an alien race? You say, "Answer the woman's question," or "Answer the lady's question." Now, it doesn't matter how good the question is. You are representing the human species to these aliens by saying, "Answer the woman's question." Setting yourself up as a man who is the only reason a woman's question is worth answering is when a man says to an alien, or says to you, "Answer the woman's question." Otherwise, ignore the question until I say, "Answer the question. Answer the woman's question." And when I heard that, I actually winced. And after a lot of wincing throughout this book, that made me wince even more. So One or two other things that I want to say here. First of all, there's too many people with the same names. So we got Sally, and then another character is called Sandy, and we've got a John Cargill, a Jonathan Whitbread, we've got a Rod, and we've got a Rob or something like that. And there's a Howland and a Horvath. This is some I made some notes of here. And there's yeah, Sally and then Renner. And there's other ones as well where you're thinking what's going on here? Who is this one? There's a Horowitz and a Horvath and a Hardy, and all of these people are in the same room together. There's like, you know, at one point there's Hardy and Horowitz and Horvath and Horace. And I'm thinking, wait a second, why do we have four people whose names all begin with H-O-R or H-A-R? So I was like, could you not just, like, and when it's an audiobook, you've only got like a second to pick up, or a quarter of a second to pick up on the name before he moves on to something else. Maybe in a book, you'd do that. Oh yeah, I just found this list here. So we go Harold, there's a Harold, a Horace, a Horvath, a Hardy, and Horowitz. That's confusing. Horace Hussein. Yeah, that's confusing already. So there's lots of confusing names in this book where I'm just thinking, why can't you just have in your book, why don't you just give all of the names, well, at least start them all with different letters? If there's going to be, there's actually way more characters than are listed on this page here. Too many characters, definitely. But there are some good characters, but the majority of the characters are bad. So I've talked for 45 minutes now about this book. It's a bit strange. I have slagged it off on a lot. It is a... I did enjoy parts of it. I think in... I was thinking of giving it 2 stars. Two and a half stars. But I think I'm going to knock it down to 2 stars because after I ranted about this book, I can't really say that I enjoyed it. In fact, I enjoyed some parts of it. And I enjoyed the aliens and I enjoyed the technology and I enjoyed some of the interactions between them. And there were some sections which were really, really good. But it was let down continuously by keep cutting back to these racist, sexist, boring, stereotypical, flat, one-dimensional humans. And each time I came back to them, I felt like shooting myself in the face with a laser. By a brownie modified laser. Anyway, that's all I've got to say about this book. Actually, there's more I could say about it, but I think I'm going to wrap up the podcast now. So 2 stars. Nah, let's call it. No, let's say 2.5 stars. 2.5 stars. I might as well give it that. So if you've enjoyed this review, email me, luke@juggler.net. Go with your own thoughts about this book. I can actually look up other people's thoughts about this book on goodreads.com. So Larry Costa, he says 4 stars. Stuart, 3 stars. Lawrence Schoen, 5 stars. Really? And you read it? You do realize you read this, he's October 9th. You've just read this, Lawrence. Did you not pick up on all the racism and sexism and the stupidity in this book? I mean, if it was a book about racism and stupidity and flat characters and sexism, I would understand it. But it doesn't seem to be a book about those things. It seems to be a book about first contact and extrapolating things out. And it doesn't address any of those points. They're just there. All of the stuff about aliens are addressed. And all of the stuff about racism is... it's not addressed. Well, it is addressed. It could be addressed. To be really nice to the book, I could say that these authors are knowing exactly what they're doing, but on their track record, Larry Niven working with Jerry Pornell really don't have a lot to go. Like Julie Davis, 5 stars? Paul, 4 stars? Lots of people have marked it to red. Felix Dance, 4 stars. So yeah, this book seems to be much higher rating. 3.82 average among my friends, which I guess are all science fiction book review podcast listeners. But really, really, I couldn't. This book really annoyed me. 2.5 stars. That's all I give it. So email me, luke@juggler.net. I'll put your review here on goodreads.com or mention, you know, you can find my review there. You can reply to my review here on goodreads.com. There'll be a link in the show notes. So email me, luke@juggler.net, I'll reply there. Also, I just want to say that anybody who is looking, if you don't know if I've reviewed a book yet, go to sfbrp.com/episode-lists, episode-lists, and there's a link right there at the front page. Every book that I've reviewed so far is listed in order of episodes in order by, like, sorted by star ratings that I give, my very, very subjective star ratings. So you can see my 0.5 rated books all the way up to my 5-star books, and also rated by author. So someone said, hey, have you read this book by Joan D. Vinge? And I say, well, check it out. I've read one book, or reviewed one book by Joan D. Vinge and two by Werner Vinge, and it's sorted down there, all of the books sorted by author. So check that out on my website. It's right there for you guys to listen to. Otherwise, yeah, you can find me on my blog, lukeburge.com/blog. I put up lots of stuff there. I write and post pictures there quite often. I'm trying to do it a few times a week, putting something new on the blog. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at Luke Burge on Twitter. Or if you care about things in my general life, mostly about juggling stuff, you can become my friend on Facebook. But if you do, put a note saying, hey, I listen to the SFBRP, so I know who you are. Otherwise, it looks just like a random friend request with no friends in common. Most of the stuff that I put on Facebook is to do with my juggling life as a professional juggler and as someone who works on that kind of stuff. So that's it for now. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll catch you next time. So quick edit here at the end. Normally I don't edit this, but I didn't read out one of my notes. At the end of this book, going back to the racism kind of thing. Maybe not racism. It's just really weird. At the end of this book, spoilers here, there's a diplomatic solution to the problem of the motis, which takes place in a chapter called The Final Solution. And when I heard that as part of the audiobook, I thought, really? This is called The Final Solution? Do you not know, like, the kind of history of that phrase, The Final Solution? And the final solution to the problem of the motis is ghettoization, to put them in a ghetto, sort of like to create a concentration camp, a forced entry into the human civilization, and with the threat of total extermination. And that is the final solution, which the authors call the final solution. Now, so maybe they know what they're playing with here, with the Holocaust language and the Holocaust imagery and the ghetto and all that kind of stuff. Maybe these guys are just way too clever for me. Maybe they're playing with the expectations of racism and anti-Semitism and beating down the black man and being afraid of the Chinese. But again, maybe that's giving them too much credit. And I can't believe that they will flippantly, in a science fiction book, address or bring up these images of the Holocaust and the final solution and all of that kind of stuff, and then just not even address them and just go, okay, this is what we're going to do, and that is the best solution to this problem. And I'm like, what the fuck? Okay, that's really the end now. Bye.